Harry Zielinski.
Raleigh Williams.
Just happy to have you here, bro. I'm excited to talk about this. I want to talk about your franchise exit. Give 2-minute background on who you are, what you have done.
2 minutes. My whole life since 15 in the restaurant industry, 59 years old. We will mention Domino's Pizza because that's where I've been majority of my career. Graduated with a hotel restaurant degree from Michigan State. Owned with Hilton Hotels for 3 years and then Domino's Pizza for 30 years. So started as a delivery driver in a 26-store.
Post-college?
Post-college.
Okay.
After I graduated. It was a crazy move. I was making $31,000 with Hilton Hotels, moving up the chain, food and beverage. And looked at my wife one day after watching Domino's destroy deliveries in my hotel. Couldn't keep them out. Said, these guys got to be doing something right. And changed careers. I went from making 31 grand salary to $4.10 an hour.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Did you get a bunch of pushback on that, or yeah. It was?
Yeah, I got a lot of pushback. She said, "Have you lost your mind? It's $160 a week. We just went broke." She said, "How are we going to survive?" And I just said, "You know, I'm going to be a franchisee in a year. This won't last forever."
Was that just Domino's as a concept just blowing up? Was that? I don't understand, or how it was going that crazy that.
You know, it really wasn't. I paid attention to one of my waitresses. She was from Ethiopia. She barely spoke English, and her husband managed for Domino's Pizza Store in Dallas, and her name was Tawabich. And I'll never forget her. She could barely speak English. She said, "Mr. Perry, Mr. Perry, you need to do Domino's Pizza. You're a hardworking man." And I said, "Tawabich, I got a career in the hotel." She said, no, my husband made $51,000 last year managing one Domino's Pizza Store. I went, "What? $51,000? I was making 25 grand with a college degree." And sure enough, long and short of it, you know, I know we're going to wrap this, we're going to run through this, but he is now a franchisee and he owns 36 stores in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Wow.
And he is an unbelievable success story. He sent his son to Harvard. His wife speaks better English than she ever has, and they live in a very nice place out in Rockwall. It is truly an amazing success story, Domino's Pizza. So I ended up visiting him. He showed me his paycheck stuff, 51 grand. I couldn't believe it. He was making as much as a food and beverage director in a major name hotel, Hilton, running one pizza store. And I said, there's gotta be something here. And that was that. That's what took off.
That's crazy. And that's amazing just to be able to, that checks all of the boxes of something that's just going gangbusters. I don't know. So was that at the kind of the peak of, how was he making that much money? It was just pizza delivery was a new, it was just the start of a new trend of people were starting to get delivery in home, and that just was the tidal wave that was coming.
It was 1988. Pizza Hut was still sit down. There was no Papa John's. So yeah, we were the only pizza delivery company in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
That's literally crazy.
In 91, Pizza Hut came out with what they called Delco units, delivery units. And that started changing things. But before that, we were it. And yes, there was more business than we could handle, kind of. It was insane.
And so you quit, you become a delivery guy, and what happens after that?
So I quit. I become a delivery guy and work my job at the Hilton. Yeah. So I check it out from the inside out. Because I wanted to make sure that, hey, what's really going on here? I needed to see how hard, difficult, what was this really about, and was there any opportunity? And the opportunity is a unique conversation because it wasn't that I saw a business that was booming and growing. I went in and saw all the flaws. I saw a diamond in the rough. I saw a business that was not being managed well, but despite itself, was making a ton of money and could still pay a guy $51,000. I went in there and said, this is so broken, I can't wait to quit and fix it.
Yeah.
So It was the my mentality more than anything. Most guys and people go in, they look for comfort, they look for a place that's got all the systems in place, they can go in and they can excel because, you know, this is a soft landing.
Yeah.
This wasn't a soft landing. This was literally landing on glass.
Yeah. So, and it was a franchisee that was not necessarily mismanaging, but undermanaging the unit. You just saw that there was more demand that could be handled operationally. It was sloppy.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was more demand, and they didn't have, quite frankly, in the mid-80s, they didn't have their shit together.
Yeah.
They were overwhelmed.
Domino's as a business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were still growing, and they were growing at leaps and bounds, and it was a mess. It was like, I don't know, it was trying to, you know, take a wild horse by thread.
I think the two really interesting things. I think the model of what is making really good money despite itself, like even though it's really poorly managed, or that's what I saw in the entertainment business when I got into it, when I did, was there's this new concept coming out called escape rooms, and these people that were horrible business people were making way more money than they deserved to make. And I think that's always a good framework of who's making more money than they deserve to make, and there's probably a good indicator there. And the other part is having gone through a growth curve before of trying to grow the business, and it feels like every system that you're trying to put in place is breaking, and it just feels like a constant shit show. Not being under a franchisor before and being the person that was in charge of it, I always felt like we're growing, like we were just, the growth and everything breaking meant that we weren't being good at business, when really it's just like growth breaks things, and growth increases your error rate because you're trying to go so fast to keep up with everything. And that's just like, that's a better problem to have than having perfectly run systems with no customers. You know
the way I look at that, Raleigh, is people vote with their dollar, and they're voting so heavily, banging at your door with their money, begging to give it to you. You're doing something right, despite yourself. We feel as operators many times that the system is broke. It's so broke we can't, you know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's so hot in the kitchen, can't wait to get out. But the fact of the matter is, people were begging for our business. I mean, they loved our model. They loved our model. We couldn't handle what we had created. And it was exciting. It was exciting times. It's exciting times now.
Yeah.
It was then in 88. It's now in, you know, 2021. It's more exciting. So, you know, I always tell my guys, you know, you get these audits. You as a franchisor probably created some audit systems if you had some franchisees in place to make sure they were running their business the way they're supposed to. If guys scored perfect scores on those in my company from an audit system, I wanted to fire them. They said, if you're not running 10% behind on manpower because your growth, you don't have enough growth, then you're doing something wrong. So, you know, if you run in a perfectly clean kitchen and everything's spotless and stuff, you need to go work for Papa John's because you shouldn't be working for me. They have a 5-star audit system at Domino's Pizza. And I used to say, my guys, if we're at 3-5-4-0 and we're double digit positive, and my EBITDA's grown at double digits every year, you're doing a lot of things right.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, follow the money.
Yeah.
People vote with their money and their dollar.
Yeah.
And if they're voting for you, they're giving you the money, you're doing a lot of things right.
Yeah. No, I think that's so then what was the next step? You were a delivery guy, and then you become a franchisee, or you stay on the operation side, and what was the next piece of the puzzle?
So the whole idea was to get my 1 year's experience, because with Domino's you have to have one full year's in management experience before you're eligible to be a franchisee. That was always my dream and my goal. But before I knew it, this was 26 stores, and next thing you know, I'm managing a store. I'm in the management training program. Then they throw me into the fire really quick. I don't know why, but within 90 days, I'm managing a store, and I could barely make a pizza. And it's a whirlwind. And all of a sudden, I'm in a low volume store out in Duncanville, Texas, driving 60 miles one way, there and back to work, taking a low-volume store and all of a sudden doubling its sales. And all of a sudden I got a name very quickly in the company. They're going, who is this new guy? He's on fire.
Yeah.
And then I got promoted to a district manager within 6 months. And then next thing you know, within 2 years, I'm running the company. So they put the golden handcuffs on me really fast. And I didn't realize what was going on. And so I didn't. So what had happened was I ended up running this company. And I never did franchise. Because the two guys I ended up partnering with that owned the company... we became best friends.
Yeah.
We all found a role that we play, and every role was significant, and it was a match made in heaven.
And a company in this context is a group that basically owned multiple units, right?
And yeah, at the time. So they owned a territory,
yep.
And within that territory, they could put as many units as they wanted.
Because they had exclusive?
That's right.
Yeah.
They had exclusivity to that particular territory.
And then you became their basically head of operations, CEO from an operations standpoint,
yes.
On managing all their units.
That's correct.
Looking back at it, getting a do-over, do you wish that you had tried to push the pedal on the gas harder and tried to be greedier with ownership and own a smaller boat that you control everything from start to finish, or be the captain of a yacht?
All right, that's a good question. So I'm going to answer that for myself. That's not going to be the same for all people. I would say to everybody that is in America, own your own business. Okay?
Yeah.
In my particular case, my partners became some of my best friends. So they allowed me to be flexible. Not only did they pay me probably 3 times more than anybody that ever did this job ever.
Yeah.
But they respected me. They allowed me to become significant. And they gave me tremendous leeway to make unbelievable decisions on my own. In my mind, I was the franchisee. In fact, a lot of the employees or team members from my franchise thought I was the franchisee.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't know any different. These two guys that I worked with were so humble and understood their roles and my role so well. They played their hands beautifully. They didn't try to be somebody they weren't.
Right.
They didn't follow behind me. They allowed me to call the shots, and we dealt with each other wonderfully.
And how did that... So as an owner, right, I've always tried to figure out the best way to offload the piece of the business that I like the least, which is usually operations, and trying to find a way to give that job to somebody,
right,
and also incentivize them to think like an owner and have some sort of economics like an owner, but also trying to keep them around. It sounds like you kind of grew up with this group, right? So you had a lot of time to feel each other out and kind of know each other organically, versus hiring somebody from the outside, where you know you're trying to hire an executive level. And it's always tough. What was the structure that they put in place, and how do you think that structure worked in terms of giving you the autonomy and also the upside to think like an owner and have that mentality?
So that's a great question, because you know, I learned early on that the most important ingredient in any pizza wasn't cheese or sauce, it was the people, right?
Yeah.
And it was that way for me. And these guys, so what they did with me, how they put the golden handcuffs on, they recognized my loyalty and my abilities, not only my work ethic, but my intelligence. And I was sort of had the pedigree that they wanted too. I had a degree in hotel restaurant management.
Yeah.
In the fast food industry, that was rare back then.
Yeah.
I mean, real rare. So I don't know how much that really had to do with anything, but I had it. and they played it, but I brought to the table. What they ended up doing was, after 5 years of working with these guys, they knew that I was going to franchise, okay, even though I was running this company. And they did a stock ghost share equity position, basically a sweat equity position with me. And for the next 10 years, they gave me 1% of the company, up to 10%.
Yeah.
So they pretty much said, you know, as we grow, you're going to get a piece of it. So not only did I get a salary for doing my job, and I got bonus for doing my job, which at the time was a percentage of EBITDA,
right.
Okay? Then I got a percentage of my sweat equity position also every 4 weeks on what the company made. Right. So I was highly, highly compensated.
From the beginning, in other words, it wasn't we're gonna mark your equity at what, you know, we've already built this thing to ourselves. From now on, everything that we grow on top of that, if you get 1% that vests every single year of the whole pie, however big the pie gets, irrespective of what we built before you.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the whole pie. They could have done, hey, we start out with, say, 25 stores. You ain't getting none of that because you weren't part of none of that. But everything above and beyond that, you're going to be a piece of, which is a smart way to do it.
Yeah.
There's 1,000 ways to skin a cat.
Yeah.
They didn't do that with me. They gave me the piece of the whole thing, the value of the whole thing.
Did you feel like that changed your mentality at all? Did that put more pep in your step? Were you trying to decide, could you feel the golden handcuff? How was that decision of going and franchising and doing your own thing? Versus staying with these guys? Did it just feel like, oh, this is what I've always wanted anyway? This is the perfect opportunity? There's a lot of...
That's a good question. So my gut tells me to answer you. My gut instinct answering your question is this. Those kind of people, they get motivated because of that. You got the wrong guy.
Yeah.
Okay? That wasn't me. I was going to give these guys 100% every day if they paid me $1 or they paid me $1 million.
Yeah.
That's the kind of cat I was, and they knew it. And they didn't want to let that cat go. That money did not motivate me at all. What motivated me was being recognized, acknowledged, having the freedom. And also, I got compensated right, too. I'm not going to discount the money part. That would be foolish because I was paid nicely. But that's not what did it for me. And actually, you know, there's statistics on this. And I know you guys all, yours know, and you know, that money's not the number one thing.
Yeah.
Money's got to be right. You know? And, you know, but more important than money is being able to recognize a man's accomplishments and doing it properly and doing it in such a way where they not only feel valued, but they feel significant, right?
Yeah.
And they feel like they're bringing something to the table. I tell people all the time, if you want to be an owner one day, you act like an owner today.
Yeah.
You don't be that later, you be it today. In all that you can be. How does that look? What does that look like? When I walk, my day started when I got into my car and drove to work and I pulled up to the office. If there was a paper on the ground from the parking lot on up and it was a 20,000 square foot building, I was picking up trash immediately.
Yeah.
Immediately. If a window was dirty on my office, it got cleaned by me. I went, the first place was the restroom to get some stuff and I started cleaning my windows. And all people see that. They see that. You may not think people see that, but everyone sees that. They have eyes on you. They watch what you do. They listen to what you say. Every word, all your actions, they have gargantuan meaning. You know, they say, and you know, this cliche-ish, but it's what you do when people aren't looking that defines you.
Yeah.
Right? And it's true. And I want to throw a little something else in here that I learned a long time ago. One of my partners said to me, he said, Perry, you know, making money in this business is awesome. But I got to tell you, there's another piece of business that I need for you to learn about. It's called real estate. And I've talked to you about this before, and I thought it never left me. He said, real estate doesn't talk back, always shows up on time, works 24/7, 7 days a week. Get into real estate. It's the best employee you'll ever have. And I remember looking at him and saying, Joe, you're wrong. It's not. The best employee, the best thing you could ever have is a great employee that's loyal. Because people build empires.
Right.
Not brick and mortar. They never will. So if you want an empire, you build it around people, right?
Yeah.
That are better than you. And most of my guys that worked with me were way better at their jobs than I could have ever dreamed of. They ran circles around me. Yeah. Made me look like a fool. And I honored them, and I served them with every bone in my body, every inch that I could. I was taking care of them and their family because I knew their weight, their value, what they brought to the table. And I felt honored to be in their presence, in my people's presence, because they're that good.
Yeah.
So.
No, yeah. I think that's interesting, and it's a, when you're an operator and you're in the people business, like you were in a massive way, trying to understand how to lead them and incentivize them, and having that as the keystone of the business. Much more than the economics. I probably lean closer to your partner and just the way that I manage people, which is why I always try to, I know that about myself, and I always try to find an operator that is much more heart driven, right? Like you are very heart driven, very gut driven, and kind of the glue side of the business that keeps all of the people together. How big was the organization outside of, I guess, the workers that were working in the various units? What did the corporate structure look like of the business, you know, supporting the respective units?
So we did all our own accounting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And at the time we made all our own food. So we had our own commissary system, which was very unique to Domino's Pizza. There was only a couple, two or three of them that did it in the whole nation. We were one of them. We had the biggest one. So we supported our stores with our dough made 6 days a week fresh in our own commissary in the heart of Dallas, which really set us apart. Had a whole team of people that did that. We had an accounting staff. We did our own payroll. We did everything internal. So I had an HR gal. So she knew every manager and every employee.
Yeah.
Commissary director knew every manager and every employee. There's a lot of accountability built in our company. Sort of like Papa Do's. I mean, these guys have their own construction company, their own.
Right.
I didn't have my own construction company, but pretty damn near close.
Yeah.
My own marketing. I mean, there was one time we were putting out so much paper and we were spending about $1.5 million a year on local advertising. That means pieces that ended up in your mail or on your door. Well, there was one time in the game where I was thinking about buying my own reams of paper from Canada and then taking my reams and trucks to a printer, because that's how much money I was spending.
Yeah.
And I knew they were making money on everything, you know? So we were extremely hands-on. We supported our stores at a very high level. There was me. I ran the whole, I had seven district managers that reported to me. And then there's one general manager in every store. And then the goal was to have four assistant managers underneath every general manager in every store.
Got it.
And then there was an owner, Dick, lived here in Dallas. He was in the office 5 days a week. And he handled a lot of the leases and things of that nature.
Yep.
And he spoke to me daily, you know, but he was pretty much, you know, he liked staying in the office and doing his thing there. He felt very comfortable there, and he made a gargantuan impact with the office staff and the girls. There were seven girls that worked in the office.
Yeah.
And that was it. We were very family oriented. I knew almost every driver. And so at the time there was 1,200, 1,300 team members by the time we were done.
Yeah.
And I knew most all of them.
And how
they knew me.
And how did the let's be done, let's get out while the getting's good, let's sell? Was it a conscious decision? Was it, oh, we just have this offer we can't refuse, or let's package this thing up and start getting this thing ready to let's go move on to greener pastures.
Yeah, so obviously that's what your show's about, right? You know, it's how to get in and how do you get out.
Yeah, right? Most people never get out.
Right.
In is easy, it's the out.
Right, it's true. And it's really something you got to think long and hard about. So we're all in players, right? My two partners have been in for 40 years, okay? So it wasn't everything that they knew, but it was like, it's what we all did, right? So getting out was very, very difficult. So what happens is that you stay in it for X amount of years and you hope that you can get out on top. Well, 3 years ago, we felt we were on top of our game. And of course, we're looking at the landscape, the economic landscape of what could be potentially happening. Also, we're taking a look at our own landscape. How are our sales? How's our bottom line? You know, and what is this really looking like? My partners were getting close to 70 years old. And they knew that, hey, in a couple, 2-3 years, we'll be 70. Well, hey, we have a timeline on all of us, right? I'm 59. I got 11 good years left in my life. That's how I look at it. That's it, 11, and they're gonna fly. People hate talking about death rate. But it's reality. So we were looking at this real strong and hard, and you know, we had top of our game, and we said, I think now's the time to package it. Now's the time to exit. And the landscape with Domino's Pizza was changing also, right? They wanted to grow more stores, and we had put in tens of millions of dollars into this company, our own money back into the product. Right. So how do you ever get that out, right? Yeah. So we just looked at it. And we felt like, hey, if we could get out at this price point, if someone was willing to pay for it, also Texas is a great place to do business.
Right.
And if the viewers are watching and they don't know that, then they need to look around. Because there is no greater state in the United States than Texas to do business.
Any California yeah. people, get out. Get out now.
East Coast people, West Coast people, good
New
luck
York,
to you.
New York,
come to Texas, baby. Texas is friendly, Texas is good, and smart business people want to be in Texas.
Was it a strategic, I talked to a lot of entrepreneurs, and a lot of people don't even, was it a conscious decision of let's get out of this thing? How do we get out of this thing? What does that process go like? Was it an ownership decision? Did the two other owners come to you and say, Perry, we got to start looking at what it's like to sell this thing? Who can?
No, it was me that went to them.
Oh, really?
Believe it or not.
You just said, I feel headwinds coming from Domino's.
No,
this isn't going to be.
No, I felt like my life would, you know, when you do what I do, As the hands-on, feet-on-the-ground guy, the guy carrying the bayonet, right? Fighting for as long as I did on the front line, taking it all for as many years as I did, there was tremendous sacrifice that comes with that. And I felt like my years are numbered.
Right.
The crowd, kids are younger, technology is really starting to come on. I'm not a highly technological kind of guy. And I felt like, quite frankly, that part of the business was starting to pass me by to a degree. And even though I could have had some guys, and I had a lot of guys that were technologically sound and all that stuff, the passion for me to get out there, put my pants on, and live inside those stores like it was starting to dissipate.
Right.
And so I'm an all-in or all-out kind of guy. I didn't feel like I could do that to my people, not lead them properly, and sort of go on the sidelines as a director of operations and not be inside those stores like I needed to be.
Right.
So having said that, it was a tough deal. I said, guys, I think my days are numbered here. And the thing was, these two guys were like, they said to me that when you're out, we're out. They said that. They didn't want to push on without me. They're maybe watch this one day and go, that's bullshit, but I think that's the truth. And they said that to me. Which maybe, obviously, it did make me feel special. But I went to the partner here in Dallas. We kind of talked about it for several weeks and stuff. And he had kind of agreed. He said, you know what? I feel you. I hear you next door to the office. I see what's going on. I see this. We're at the top of our game. Do we leave stuff potentially on the table? Yeah, but. And the two guys that took over that bought our company are doing great.
Yeah.
But it was our time to go.
Yeah.
And we knew we could go out on top.
And from an operational playbook side of operating the business, prepping it for a sale, was there a change navigating that, right? Navigating an exit for the first time. What were the, like, okay, how do we go about doing that? How do we go about maximizing? What do we need to do? How are those?
So, you know, make that decision? The two guys, the primary owners, right?
Yeah.
They reached out to a couple different consultants to help package this business.
Yeah.
In order to deliver to potential investors, they had to get it ready to sell.
Yeah.
On my end, you and I briefly talked about this before we got in here. I thought about that some more after you asked me that earlier. You know, I tried to keep things exactly the way they were.
Yeah.
Till the last day I left. I mean, it was like, in my mind, I was going to go out better than when I came in.
Yeah.
So both flags roaring, pistols out shooting. Nobody knew the difference. Yeah. I mean, you know, we were going to go down in a blaze of fire.
Which is tough. It's tough when you're under diligence and you get an LOI and you get an offer for something and you see a bunch of zeros and you say, this is what we're going to get. And then you have that high, and then you have another 8 months of diligence on how the business does, and it's tough to keep that energy from getting the initial offer and then dealing with all of the crap that comes along with selling, you know what I mean? And keeping the energy and keeping everybody gung-ho without them really having a ton of context of why we're almost pushing harder than we ever have. What's the point, you know?
Right, but you know, and I know, and a lot of your people are gonna listen know, that a deal's never done till done.
Yeah, you have to keep cranking.
So the last thing you wanna do on your exit out is leak it or do anything and make it sound like we're moving on down the road to greener pastures.
Nah, yeah,
you never wanna do it because the deal may not close.
Yeah.
And then you're really screwed. Because then you showed your people your hand that you're really not as loyal as you thought they thought you were, even though we were, but, you know. No, then they're second guessing and going, well, if they're not loyal to me, then they're going to start bailing on you. And that's the last thing you want.
Yeah. No, it's tough. Whether it's the sale process or in the operations of just the whole time as a franchisee, what is something that if you could have a mulligan that you just felt like was a mistake that you made, something that you just
messed up? On the sale side of it?
Whatever, whether it's on the sale or just all throughout that whole time that you were at that group, the thing you could just have a take back on.
I think if you asked the three of us, me and my two partners, if we could have a do-over, what would we do over?
Yeah.
What would we do differently? And I would say that we would have put a lot more money and time and energy into the training element of our business than we did. I think that we promoted some guys too quickly, okay?
Yeah.
And earlier on, I was very much a hothead. And a very young, ambitious leader who did not choose the right words, did not have the capacity for compassion and understanding like I should have. Specifically, our people go through a lot of stuff in their lives. And it's really quick, it's really easy to pull the trigger and judge one of your people when you don't have all the facts.
Yeah.
And as I grew older in the business, I started doing things very differently. I didn't change things as... The longer we went on in our business, I used to change things quick and drop it down.
Right.
Quick, go that direction, do that, do this. And I stopped doing that. You know, after 15 years in business, I said, stop. Change is not good for our people. They do not like that kind of change, especially when it had to do with their money. And also, you know, terminating people and stuff. I just, you know, I always have said to my guys, I said, Father Time is the greatest teacher of all. It's not a textbook. It's not a, you know, YouTube video. It's time. And that's what, if you think about it, back in the day, that's how fathers taught their sons. There wasn't, you know, business as usual. There was farming. And who did his dad have by his side? His son.
Yeah.
And every day he was with his son. And every day the son got to watch his dad grow crops, watch his dad sharpen a knife, watch his dad. And so Father Time taught that boy how to be successful and survive. And I think we've lost that in our world because it feels like time just flies and there's no time to do the right thing.
Right.
And sometimes the best meal isn't the one that's made in 7 minutes. It's the one that sits in the crock pot for 20 hours. Right?
Yeah.
Has time to simmer and cook. And I think, you know, I learned that in my older years as a leader, as a CEO, that the crock pot method of mentoring, teaching, and leading is really ultimately gives the best results.
Yeah.
My guys were with me for years. My team of guys, my youngest guy in seven district managers is like 15 years with me. These guys were loyal to us and loyal to me. They could have all franchised.
Yeah.
They didn't. They stayed because, you know, I gave them most of the credit. I made them feel significant. Yeah. I honored them, and they liked the place that they worked, and they felt like what a great place to work. And I paid them very handsomely.
Right. Is there an exception to that? What's the category of behaviors that you feel is an exception to that rule of the crockpot rule and give people time to get trained and marinate? I always feel like I'm too slow to fire people that I have a sense aren't great for the job. And I agree with you that it's largely my fault for lack of training. I try to hire people that I assume already know how to do things.
Ooh.
Right?
Man.
and this is part of the benefit of being in a franchisee system is you have an operating platform that you can build on top of versus starting something from scratch and trying to build standard operating procedures from start to finish. My tendency has always been, you don't really know who you have until you're working with them. And the best way to hire is to fire fast, which okay. is the opposite.
So
but I like what you're saying.
Let me address what you said. Cause you're bringing up a very, very good point. So here's the deal. In the interview process, you take the time to make sure that you're hiring the right people. Now, I know we don't have a crystal ball.
Yeah.
I know a lot of guys and gals out there are polished interviewees and they can get through it.
Right.
But laying out the expectation in the interview, the job expectation, 10 minutes early, shirt is washed clean. You must wear a black belt. You must wear socks. Hair can't be below, you know, an inch on the beard. You right. go over all the standards in the interview process. Okay?
Yeah.
They clearly communicate back on what the expectation is. And if at the beginning, this is the key. Okay? This answers your question. If at the beginning they violate that basic protocol that was laid before them in the interview process, they're gone.
Yeah.
You cut bait immediately. So I call it the catch and release program, right?
Yeah.
You catch them and you're paying really close. The problem is we don't pay close attention to them after we hire them.
Right.
And we let them skate because, oh, well, we give them break. No. Not at the very beginning, you don't, right? Once they pass that 30 day whatever and they come clean or whatever, and then they make a mistake down the road, down the line, then I, as your boss, you're the one that hired this cat, gentleman back here on the camera, I would say to you, Raleigh, you are the failure. It's not him that needs to be fired. You need to go look in the mirror. You didn't take care of business. You weren't following up with this guy. The reason he's gone right now is because you failed him miserably. He passed the first 30 days. He was a good employee. He was great. I watched him a little. I saw him. He was outstanding. You, my friend, either assumed, made some assumption, went on another way, forgot about him, and then he started to drift and you weren't doing your job. You didn't pull him back in line. And so he slowly but surely you know, swept away. And now you're forced to fire him. So the biggest problem I feel in this industry is failure to communicate expectation on the front end before they're hired.
Yeah.
And find out their commitment before they're hired. That's the biggest problem. And I see it time and time again in these stores and in retail units. How one time I went into a Burger King and I fired an employee as a customer. He thought I was the owner. And I told him he was terminated. I said, come out from back of the counter. The kid came from back from the counter. In front of my district manager was watching this. He's like, have you lost your mind? And I told this kid, I said, I'm going to have to let you go. Manager started coming out. I said, what's going on here? I said, I'm just firing your team member. He goes, who are you? I said, just a customer. You didn't do that. My district manager's sitting there laughing. He's going, this is insane. This guy really thought that you owned the store. It was crazy. But I digress. I really feel like that's a big deal. That is gargantuan right then and there. So it's catch and release. They pass this process. If the managers continue to do what they're supposed to do as management and lead their people, because I've always said, I got a bunch of cliches, great leaders always find ways to draw the greatness out of their people.
Yeah.
Every one of us has got a combination in a safe. And the great leaders take the time to dial in, to get the right combo, and pick that safe and draw that greatness out and grab those jewels. That's what great leaders do. And we just don't take the time to do that.
Yeah.
Did that answer your question?
No, that's, yeah, definitely. Because it's always, and the key differentiator is setting clear expectations and having the SOPs and also giving them, you know, that's the benefit of, I've owned businesses before where there've been, where I've handed over operations and you get kind of a heavy-handed operator that wants to put in place, you know, dress codes and, you know, you have the old guard that's been running the business for a long time that kind of bucks it all of that. And they say, what do we need those things for? You know, we've always had great customer service, blah, blah, blah. And so it's always hard to bring the leash back once you've let it go.
Exactly. Exactly. And
so just having things from an operational standpoint that it's a tight leash, even if it's somewhat arbitrary, just for the sake of having a tight leash, just to have kind of indicators of what it is, of how someone's going to act in the first 30 days is a big piece of it, because then as things get in grayer and grayer areas, it's always tough when you try to correct somebody and you feel like they didn't have that expectation from the front side. And then it's really hard to do, and then you're training on the job for everyone, which means that you got to be there for every training because it's this like tribal passed down knowledge of the way that the business is supposed to operate, which keeps you as the owner in the business and not working on the business from a growth perspective. So I think that's the big switch, is from an interview perspective, very, very clear expectations and KPIs. The tough part, I think, is when you have a lot of growth in the business and you're bringing new positions in that you've never had before.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
And you don't really know what the KPIs are, you know, what the key indicators are that you're going to judge somebody against. And, you know, like if you were to bring in a marketer for the first time, right, your first CMO that you ever hire, and you've never had one before, that's where it's tough to know when to keep them, and there's not a standard against which their performance can be measured, because it's like, you know, you're being the pioneers together on what this new position right. will do in the business. And that's a tough piece.
That is a tough piece. Now you have to do your due diligence as the guy who created that position to make sure you set as many, I guess you call them KPIs or standards,
yeah,
or whatever expectations as possible before they come in.
Yeah.
But you're right. But I'll tell you, most of the time, it's the manager, it's the person that hired them, it's their fault.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you straight.
No, I agree. And I'm usually the person hiring people. And I know it's my fault.
Yeah. And who's firing you?
The customers.
Exactly. That is a very good point. That's right. So when the business goes south, you don't have to, you can't look at all the employees that screwed you down the line. You're going to go look in the damn mirror and then look at your banker and go, guilty as charged.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah.
So accountability is critical. And, you know, I'm a big proponent of that, of looking in the mirror constantly. I look at people, and when I have difficult employees, I always said the difficult ones were always my best. They were always my best. People typically looked at those, they got to fire those guys. I said, time out, that's bullshit. Absolutely not. Those are the best. Those are the ones that are fearless. Those are the ones that have enough courage to tell you like it is. Most people kiss your ass. They don't tell you shit. And you never find out what's really going on in your business.
Yeah.
Who wants to know that? I want to grow my sales and my bottom line. And if I have an employee that has enough guts to step up and tell me the way it is in front of everybody, maybe the delivery wasn't the best. Granted, sometimes it's hard to taste. But I've gotten called out in large meetings. Called out in front of 100. And I got to tell you, it's not good. It doesn't feel good. That's true. But I also had to straight, because a lot of my people would come to me, right? Like the apostles would come to Jesus and say, that wasn't really good. And then Jesus would say, I got this. And then deal with those employees one-on-one, which I did. I always did. I always addressed it, right?
Yeah.
Employees hot about something, whatever, and they decide to lose their shit inside one of these rallies or these meetings. I got those people, and they were extremely beneficial to the growth of my company. And they kept them forever. And people always used to say, why don't you fire those guys, man? They're pains in the asses. I said, those are the only ones that get up. The rest of them just kiss my ass. I said, oh, you know, when I saw stores, Raleigh, when I saw my pizza stores, nobody ever knew where I was ever. Ever. I never did announced visits. You see these CEOs fly in. Everybody knows the red carpet rolls out. $3 store. Those are bullshit rounds. Those are owners that don't give a shit about their company nor their people.
Yeah.
I used to drive around cities, 16 different cities I had. I'd drive around all day, 10, 12 hours, and nobody ever knew where I was. I go from one city, I go four other cities. Then I go hit two or three stores, maybe, and then I go over 45 miles one way, one store, hit 60 miles another one. They go, this guy's all over the place, because they all try to call each other, right? Here he comes again. He's coming. He's coming. But I just wanted to see with my own eyes what the customers were seeing.
Yeah.
And I wanted to hear with my own ears what the employees had to say in the middle of the day at 2 o'clock when I walked in.
Right.
And sometimes they didn't know who I was. Those are the best visits of them all.
Yeah.
Because they would say, I'd walk in. I remember one time I was in a store. Phone kept ringing or getting hammered in the middle of the afternoon, me and this shift runner. And this kid's cussing. He's like, damn phone won't stop ringing. Can't stand that damn phone. Didn't know who the hell I was. I'm making pizzas, and I looked at him and said, if that phone weren't ringing, son, you wouldn't have a job, neither would I. I'm the CEO of this company. You are? I said, yeah. I said, we got to talk. And obviously, he was understaffed. His manager put him in a position to fail, blah, blah, blah. But there's a lot of learning in that.
Yeah. No, I think that's the... That's the operational, that's so operationally key without, and that's the temptation as the owner. And I talk to people about moving out of operations and focusing on revenue and then focusing on growth. But if you're too many, the temptation is always to remove yourself from the customer interfacing piece and the real operating piece of the business. And as you start working on the business, you have to have somebody. That's why I think the phantom equity piece is such a crucial piece of giving somebody that's still an owner of the business. Maybe they won't have the same economics as the original owners, but having somebody that's got financial upside and downside in what the customer experience looks like and having them be completely focused on it, that's the only way to scale it. Because
I totally agree.
A high salary isn't enough.
That's how you scale a business. And that's how you scale multiple businesses, by the way. I mean, I met a guy that had six different businesses, and his first right-hand man got a piece of all six businesses.
Yeah.
And this guy, but his main role was this one business.
Yeah.
But as he grew the business, so too did his right-hand man grow.
Right.
In all of his ventures. So there was a sense of accountability there. In essence, like, hey, when my owner's not around, he's making me money because right. he's thinking about another concept. And I totally believe in that.
Yeah, it's huge.
Share the wealth. Yeah. Don't be greedy.
No.
Don't be greedy.
You won't. Yeah, there's...
Nope. Do the right thing. Share the wealth. And I'll tell you, I mean, no doubt about it. And my two partners were like that.
Yeah. What is what do you feel like is something that either you believe now that you don't, that you didn't used to believe, or something that you don't believe now that you used to believe? A belief that's changed over the past year or two, whether it's post sale or whatever, just in the past.
You know, when I first started out, I believed that diligently watching every single penny to the bank made the difference. And now I see that there's a lot more than that. You know, I was a penny, I was the kind of guy that could step on a penny. And I could tell you heads or tails by the way it felt on my big toe. And even to this day, I don't stop. I will never not pick a penny up. But value the little things, but don't let the little things run your business. In other words, you have to have a bigger vision than that. There's always reasons why. There was never an excuse or a reason why a shirt should have been on my floor in a Domino's pizza store. On the floor.
Yeah.
I used to lose it. That shirt was $16. You know, I'm making 8 cents out of every dollar. I could turn that one shirt into X amount of revenue that I had to pay for that shirt. And it was like, you know, I don't know, $300-$500 in pizza revenue to pay for one shirt.
Right.
That's what my mentality was all the time. But you know what? Now, the wiser CEO, the wiser guy now says, I wonder why that shirt's on the floor. Let's find out why that shirt's on the floor. So I take more time now than I ever have in my life trying to figure out trying to get the answer why, and try to understand more now about why things happen than just addressing than I am the end result.
Yeah, it's because it makes a ton of sense, because the natural inclination is to go give a sermon on something, on how many pizza revenue that could have been lost, and you've lost the opportunity to get the most out of the feedback possible, because everyone, walls go up, right? You come in hot-headed with how much everyone is wasting, and you can't ever get to That's the right. real answer once you lead in hot on how wasteful everyone is. You can't ever get to the answer anymore of what's really going on, and the feedback that you could be getting to ultimately address the essential piece.
Well, the reason why, and I'm more interested in the journey than I am the end goal. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'm interested in my people and the journey and how that transpired, and what tell me all about that journey, and that specifically of the shirt. How did that shirt get on that floor? Yeah. Tell me the journey, and I'll end up finding out that we were totally understaffed. There's a really good reason right. why that shirt hit the floor.
Right.
And like, holy Toledo, I got a much bigger problem than that shirt on the floor.
Right.
I just lost $300 in lunch sales because we were so understaffed, couldn't get my phone, blah, 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 blah. Right?
Yeah.
Had nothing to do, but the shirt, the wanting to understand why the shirt hit the floor leads me to much bigger issues and opportunities than there would be saving a $16 shirt on the floor.
Yeah.
That shirt still needs to be picked up though. And the end goal needs to be, that shirt, gotta figure out how to get that shirt hung up. So we gotta work on that. And we gotta, now this is what we're gonna do differently to get that shirt hung up.
And the last question, because I've asked you this before and I like the answer that you gave, it helped change my perspective. Looking at, if you were to start over from scratch again, and you could only go down a franchisee route or a non-franchisee, because I've always looked at being a franchisee as kind of working for the guys that started the concept, and like I would say I've always looked at it as like a lesser version of entrepreneurship for some, like, I don't know why that's always been my viewpoint. Like, it's for
I think it's
for yuppies that can't you know, do real entrepreneurship and come up with their own stuff and be their real own boss. But I've heard of so many people that have been so much more, it's just the people that you know that have been so much more successful leveraging the franchise systems and the operational piece of it. So the question is, to franchise or not to franchise if starting out from scratch, knowing that ultimately you want to exit, what would you look for? What's the criteria that a franchise system makes sense and the criteria where you just say, just go and...
What was my answer?
That was such a good answer?
Yeah. What did I say? Remind me.
You said that you would stay on the franchising piece if there's brand equity in the franchise system,
right,
and because you let somebody else go through the whole learning curve of the operations of the business, and you're starting with an operational foundation in place that you can build upon, as opposed to starting with just a piece of dirt that you got to figure out everything. And also the other interesting piece, as coronavirus has happened and still you and your family still being in that world, the ability to weather the storm, there's a lot more resources in a franchise system and a lot more growth potential if it's done correctly versus just being on your own little canoe that you can call every shot and get to make every operational procedure. But when a storm comes, it's way better to be on a cruise liner
right,
than it is to be in a canoe that you own.
Right. So, yeah, I kind of remember that answer. So, yeah, brand presence, you know, if the brand presence is positive and long-lived, like Domino's was, right, and there's a lot of people who would love to be Domino's Pizza franchisees right now.
Right.
I mean, Domino's Pizza went from $2.85 14 years ago to over $430 4 months ago. So it's a Harvard textbook. It is literally about what capitalism is all about. The Domino's Pizza story is literally what America was built on. There's no, these guys, delivery drivers, multimillionaires, in a significant way.
Yeah.
I'm not talking $1, $2, $3, $4, $5 million guys. We're talking $30, $40, $50, $60, $100 million guys. They were delivery drivers, no education, and growing still as we speak today. So there was a lot, Domino's had a lot to offer. And the other thing is, today's day and age, I would look for a franchise that is obviously tech savvy, social media savvy is tech savvy. It's almost like one and the same nowadays.
Yeah.
Okay, the processes are important. That's what a franchise brings to the table. All franchises bring processes to the table, right? Which they'll all bring, but being tech heavy and tech savvy, social media is also would be critical for me right now. And that's the thing, you know, that's the thing I would lean on. But if I had an opportunity, and you know, to start something new is very, very difficult.
Yeah.
It is. And you know, when you're in this brand for 65 years and you see how much we still don't know in Domino's, as much as we think we know, because we're learning every day, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
And when you know, I've been in it for 30 years and knowing, I mean, Domino's Pizza continues to change its processes as we speak.
Right.
So I can see where you were coming from. You're young. And you're thinking these guys just can't cut it in the real world? They're not real entrepreneurs?
No, it's stupid. Who cares? It's right. All about the dollars and cents.
Right. But the dangerous thing is, the more you experience and the more you live and the more you think you know as you grow older, even you're going to say this in 20 years. You're going to remember me saying this. You're going to come to a place right now, you're going to say, the only thing I know is how much I don't know.
I know nothing.
That's the truth. You can mark that one up. I mean, I know now more about how little I know than I ever have in my entire life.
That's a wrap.
That's a wrap.
We know nothing.